Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's announcement today at the National Holocaust Museum that he was commissioning the first ever national intelligence estimate on mass killings that his newly created Atrocities Prevention Board would not be treating as an afterthought or a sideline in our foreign policy. Rachel Gerber, who works on human protection and worked for the UNHCR and was present at the Holocaust Museum, joins us. Then we'll look into the results of the first round of the French presidential elections that seem to spell the end for Nicolas Sarkozy. Philippe Malliere joins us. He is a professor of French and European politics at the University College in London, who studies the French socialist parties, French politics, and European social democracy. We will discuss the alarming rise of the French right, who got one-fifth of the vote, largely from young French workers, 30% of whom are unemployed. Then finally, as stocks plunge today in Europe and on Wall Street as a result of the French elections and the collapse of the Dutch government, we'll revisit the malaise in the Eurozone, where the cost of Spanish debt has reached unsustainable levels, austerity has proven to be disastrous, and there is no money for stimulus. The head of the Levy Economics Institute, Dimitri Papadimitriou, joins us. Joining us now is Rachel Gerber, who's a program officer in the Stanley Foundation's Policy and Outreach Department, where she's responsible for human protection programming. Prior to joining the foundation, she worked for the UNHCR and the United Nations Office in Geneva on issues related to refugee resettlement, UN system-wide coherence, interagency collaboration, and the Millennium Development Goals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rachel Gerber.
Thank you very much for having me.
And the Stanley Foundation, just briefly, what do they do?
The Stanley Foundation is a foreign policy nonprofit based in Muscatine, Iowa, that focuses heavily on global governance issues, particularly emphasizing multilateral cooperation. And so we work primarily in the areas of human protection, which is the policy area that I head, as well as nuclear security and global governance.
And you were today you were at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., where President Obama announced a couple of things. He announced setting up an agency of some kind or a board, I think it was, essentially.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And also he announced proposals to stop the use of new internet technology and communications technology by oppressive regimes like the Iranians and the Syrians, suggesting that this new technology should be used to power individuals, not to oppress them. Let's begin with the first part of it, of what is this board that the president's suggesting needs to be set up?
Right. Well, the president's speech really put forward several things that have been ongoing for a while in development within the U.S. government. And one of these is this Atrocities Prevention Board, which is essentially a high-level decision-making structure that brings together leaders of all of the key central executive branch agencies that have a role to play in atrocity prevention. So that would be the State Department, USAID, Homeland Security, the intelligence bureaus, et cetera. And so it's a board that brings together leadership from each of these agencies to focus specifically on the threat of mass atrocities, this particular form of violence, and you know what threats are occurring worldwide and how we can better approach policy to counter those threats.
So what kind of leadership would it have, and would that person have cabinet-level rank or assistant secretary rank? How's it going to work?
Well, it has a relatively complex structure. They've laid out some of the parameters just in the talking points that were released along with in the White House press release today after the president's speech. It goes into a bit more detail, but it does have, I believe, at the assistant secretary level, participation from each of the agencies. It's then chaired within the National Security Council, so it therefore has direct access to the White House.
So when you talk about Atrocities Prevention Board, one, of course, is immediately reminded of the fact that there's been precious little prevention of atrocities in recent history, Rwanda being a hideous example, and then the Bosnian War, and then the Kosovo War. And now, of course, it's very apparent in Syria what's happening in terms of the wholesale slaughter of civilians who are bravely facing military power, often with little to no arms. So 10,000 people at least have been killed so far. So, and I know the president talked about Syria at the moment, but what's being done? What can be done?
Well, that is the question, and you're very right that all of these initiatives stem from essentially the memory of a lot of past failures. And over the last more than a decade now, there's been a global community that's been trying to figure out how we can do this better, how we can counter atrocities better. And there was the initial Responsibility to Protect principle that was sort of inaugurated in 2001. It was then acceded to by world leaders in 2005. And so you have these global initiatives. And then more recently, the U.S. government, you know, really trying to get to the concrete of how to do this better and really institutionalize it within the system. And yet, as we see, of course, crises are still ongoing. You have Syria, but you also have many other crises that are manifesting very heavily against civilians in a targeted sense, meaning civilians are the target of the violence. Clearly, the tensions right now between Sudan and South Sudan are a big concern. You have the Congo, so Syria is not the only question still out there where we haven't necessarily found the answer. And I think the difficulty is when something like this board is set up, there's this sort of intuitive sense of, oh, well, now we should be able to approach Syria better, when the reality is this has been a process ongoing for a while, and you have a lot of key figures within the U.S. government that are completely seized by Syria as is, and these are a lot of the same figures that are involved in this atrocity prevention board. So they're really trying to focus as best they can, deal with a very tough situation that doesn't have a lot of good options, and at the same time be learning those lessons for the long term. And what this board will focus on is those long-term improvements in the U.S. government's response.
Again,
as we say, it's not as though they are not paying attention to Syria.
Again, I'm speaking with Rachel Gerber, who is a program officer at the Stanley Foundation, where she's responsible for human protection programming. And prior to joining the foundation, she worked for the United Nations Human Rights Commission and the United Nations Office in Geneva. And interestingly enough, Rachel Gerber, the current UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, she's been extremely outspoken about what's happening in Syria, also pointing out that the Assad regime are torturing children in front of their parents, etc. I mean, it's just hideous what they're doing. So you have this kind of two-track situation going on now, where you have Kofi Annan trying to make a deal with Assad and the Russians. And on the other hand, you've got the UN Human Rights Commissioner basically saying that the Assad regime should be referred to the International Criminal Court. Who's got the upper hand in your mind?
It's a very good question. And actually, you know, I wouldn't, how do I put it? When you're dealing with these sort of complex situations, often it's actually important to have voices that have differentiated roles and responsibilities. And it would be very difficult for someone in Kofi Annan's position to come out and say some of the same statements as High Commissioner Nabi Bey has, you know, been in a position to say. And yet those messages also still need to be put across. And I don't think anything's off the table at this point. So I'm not sure it's a matter of who has the upper hand or who has the right answer. I think there are a lot of complex messaging strategies going on that, you know, are mutually reinforcing in some ways, even though sometimes they seem dissonant, and we'll just have to see how the process continues.
So how does this new atrocities prevention board that the president announced proposing setting up today at his speech at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., how does it tie into the Responsibility to Protect, which is something that was the Canadians originally came up with, and it sort of made its way into the, I suppose, into the political and international geopolitical world somewhat haltingly with ambivalent support. Is this going to buttress R2P?
Well, I think it is. I think, I mean, essentially, R2P is the conceptual inspiration for all of these policies that are being implemented. It's the political impetus as well as the commitment articulated. And I think what's difficult about the Responsibility to Protect, or R2P, is that it's often seen visibly external to the policy discussions only for its intervention elements. So clearly we saw in Libya it was invoked, the Security Council resolutions, and there's been a lot of analysis since then about how Libya relates to the Responsibility to Protect. The Responsibility to Protect actually outlines many layers of responsibility, most of which are in the category of prevention and do not require any intervention and certainly no military force. And this Atrocity Prevention Board is very much focused in a similar way. The goal is to understand the dynamics of atrocity risk so that they can be foreseen, further and further ahead, so that there can be engagement, you know, in the realm of development assistance for security sector reform, justice sector reform, other elements of sort of the institutional structures of individual countries, so that they are less likely to be susceptible to future leaders who may decide to choose civilian targeted strategy. So the Atrocity Prevention Board and the policies they're trying to integrate by harnessing the whole U.S. government and bringing in the development actors, bringing in a lot of the interagency, aside from pure DOD or pure state, is in order to address these elements that are also part and parcel to the responsibility to protect. So there really is a very deep parallel. I tend to think of RTP as just the and its relationship to atrocity prevention. Essentially, I mean, they're synonymous, except that RTP is just a political articulation of those same broader policy motivations, and it's not restricted to military intervention in a Libya-type case.
Well, you were there today, Rachel Gerber, at the Holocaust Museum when the president made these announcements. He was introduced by Elie Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor, who made a rather sort of dark and pessimistic introduction, did he not, suggesting that the whole idea of never again is not necessarily in the ascendancy in the world today, that Assad is killing his people freely, and the world's number one Holocaust denier, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, could end up with a nuclear weapon and destroy the Jewish state, etc. So obviously the president is under threat from the Republicans and the right wing in this country for not being sufficiently pro-Israel. How did the president address that issue, having been introduced in that kind of dark and pessimistic way?
Well, I mean, I think he was put in that context, and I think initially having the announcement made at this particular time sort of naturally opened the door to that being the announcement context. I mean, it is at the end of Holocaust Remembrance Week, and there are those linkages there, so I think there was a natural reflection on past failures, which, again, you had referenced earlier, the Holocaust clearly being a past failure, but Rwanda, the Balkans, and others that came afterwards, and it is difficult. It's easy to have that sort of dark vision of where we are. I think the president did a very good job of reflecting on that, on giving credence to that, but then also pointing out how things have shifted and where we're focused on doing better. And I think that was the primary thrust of his discussion, while also respectfully acknowledging that history. And I think if you look at the record, he actually began the speech, and the White House press release gives a much more detail of some of the accomplishments of the last several years, of investments that have been made that, you know, it's not clear where they'll head necessarily, but seem to have improved or staved off worse potential for violence. For example, the referendum in South Sudan that came off peacefully, and of course now there's heightened tension. It's clearly not a situation that is resolved. But the fact that the international community and the U.S. government in particular was so engaged in that process does seem to have had an impact in keeping things together up to this point, to a certain degree, in a way that maybe it would not have in the past. So I think the president did a good job of clearly marking those accomplishments. But you're always in that difficult situation of, you know, prevention has no evidence. So if you succeeded, it's really hard to identify that. So I think he attempted to balance and factor that in while still respecting the reality that we are not in a position yet to fully stop these forms of violence to the degree that we would wish was the case.
So given how much dictators and murderers in recent history have hidden behind national sovereignty, it's certainly refreshing to have a president of the United States say that national sovereignty is never a license to slaughter your people. So it would seem, just in the overall scheme of things, that at least there's some new thinking here in terms of non-military ways of responding to basically what's been happening since the end of the Cold War, where, you know, rogue actors have been killing their own people. And the first one we went after was Noriega, then Milosevic, Saddam Hussein a couple of times, etc. We've always gone after, gone to war against countries in order to get the criminals running these countries, and the people of these countries are the collateral damage. Their only crime is that they live under dictatorships.
Right. And I mean, I just would underscore again, with this issue, the focus really is on how can you counter the incentives for leaders to target their civilians without resorting to force, for all the reasons one can imagine. And I think we're starting to better understand that. And as you say, it was so encouraging to hear the president reaffirm that national sovereignty can't be used as an excuse to slaughter one's own people. And the notion that there can be tools and things that can be applied before force becomes necessary is something we really need to explore further and deepen our ability to approach in a policy sense.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Rachel Gerber.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Rachel Gerber, who's a program officer in the Stanley Foundation's Policy and Outreach Department, where she's responsible for human protection programming. Prior to joining the foundation, she worked for the United Nations Human Rights Commission and the United Nations Office in Geneva on issues related to refugee resettlement, UN system-wide coherence, interagency collaboration, and the Millennium Development Goals. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the French elections.
In the springtime, I love Paris in the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Philippe Malliere, who's a professor of French and European politics at University College London. In 2007, he was awarded the Marcel Liebman Chair in Political Science by the Université Libre de Bruxelles. His main publications are about the French Socialist Party, French politics, and European social democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philippe Malliere.
Hello.
And you wrote a piece recently in The Guardian of the UK, France Grows Tired of Nicolas Sarkozy, its half-baked president. I guess in terms of the results, the elections were almost half-baked with François Hollande, the socialist, coming in at 28.6% to Sarkozy's 27.1%. What's your response to the election?
Yes, on the face of it, they are neck and neck. There's only one and a half points between the two front runners. In reality, and this is probably the complexity of the French system compared to the American one, in the first ballot, in order to be elected, any candidate needs to secure at least 50% of the share of the vote, which is no one has ever achieved that, not even De Gaulle in the 1950s. So there's a second ballot where only the two front runners qualify. And the reason why, you know, I can confirm my prediction that, in fact, Sarkozy is in deep water and will probably lose the election in 2 weeks' time, is that when you look at the transfers of votes between all the candidates on the left and on the right, it appears that Hollande is largely ahead. You know, the predictions today are, you know, the difference of 56% against 44. That's on average what you get.
Well, isn't this the first time since the foundation of the Fifth Republic that a president has lost an election?
Absolutely. It is the first time since the launch of the Fifth Republic back in 1958 that an incumbent president loses the first round, which, you know, it's a very, very poor start for Sarkozy. And, of course, again, that isn't to say that he will necessarily lose the second round, but again, the rapport de force, the difference between left and right, that is Hollande for the left and Sarkozy for the right, is again detrimental to Sarkozy. Hollande is in a much stronger position. Then there is, of course, the big question mark, which is, of course, the surge of the far right, Marine Le Pen's candidacy, who came third in a race. She got 18% of the share of the vote, which is a very good result, the best result ever for the French extreme right. And again, you might think, you know, extreme right, and the vote should go to the closest candidate, which is the Sarkozy on the right. That's more complex because, in fact, you realize when you study the sociology of that electorate, it is a very heterogeneous type of electorate. Of course, a majority of them, about 50% of them, will vote for Sarkozy, but there is a significant fraction which will vote for Hollande, and the rest will abstain. Those voting for Hollande will do it on the grounds that on socioeconomic matters, Hollande is, of course, being a socialist, being a social democrat. They'll be better off with him. That shows that in the electorate of Le Pen for the far right, you have now a substantial amount of blue-collar working-class people.
Well, conversely, I guess the leftist candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who is backed by the Communist Party, he came in fourth with almost 12%, and he very emphatically and unconditionally urged his supporters to vote for Hollande in the runoff. I find it very interesting, and I'm sure a lot of commentators in Europe, Philippe Malliev, are quite concerned about the rise of the vote, where one in five French voters voted for the far-right candidate, even though she's not a traditional fascist like her father. The notion that the young, unemployed, working-class French are voting for this somewhat xenophobic candidate. We have 50% unemployment amongst the young in Spain, I believe. Unemployment amongst the young in France is close to 30%, isn't it?
Yes, that's about a figure, yes. I think, yes, there was, I think the result, you mentioned the left front led by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who, by the way, is not a representative of the far left. He's someone who comes from the Socialist Party. So not so long ago, he was a member of Hollande's party. He was a cabinet minister in Lionel Jospin's government in 2002. So he's a man who, in fact, gave up on social democracy altogether, thinking it's far too centrist now, far too in line with free market politics. Although, to be fair, the French Socialist Party is very different from, say, the UK counterpart, you know, Tony Blair's, Gordon Brown's New Labour. They're more to the left of that, but still not left-wing enough for him. So the phenomenon around Mélenchon is very interesting. Although he didn't get finally the 15% or so that the polls were predicting at some point, he still got 11% of the share of the vote. He is supported by the communists, but also he's supported by a coalition of other left-wing groups and parties. And it's not, in my view, a kind of nostalgia for 1970s-style politics, you know, class against class. It's a new left which is developing, and I think France is probably at the forefront of this new left coming up. It's a left which is, in fact, has made an assessment of the current economic crisis, saying, well, neoliberalism has failed, and the current austerity policies very much induce my monetarist policies and thinking will be bound to fail. Look at Greece, look at Portugal, look at Spain, they argue. It is bound to fail. So We need a break. We need to really do something very different. And that has proved very appealing to a number, not at all of far-left-wing people, people who would normally vote for the far-left, but people who would normally vote for the socialist. That is, people working in the public sector, teachers, nurses, young people, retired people have been coming en masse. And I think Mélenchon is a superb orator, the best orator in the campaign, drew to his rallies, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in Marseille, in Paris. It was very, very impressive. So in the end, this electorate will be very disciplined. They'll vote en masse for Hollande. Why, you might say, because I've just said they're quite disillusioned with social democracy. They'll do it because they want anyone but Sarkozy in power. So, of course, they will vote for the lesser of the two evils. And, of course, Hollande, nonetheless, however moderate he might be for them, is still a man on the left.
Again, I'm speaking with Philippe Mallier, who's a professor of French and European politics at the University College in London. In 2007, he was awarded the Marcel Liebman Chair in Political Science by the Université Libre de Bruxelles. His main publications are about the French Socialist Party, French politics, and European social democracy. So in a curious way, of course, Sarkozy himself is a throwback to Ronald Reagan here in the United States and Margaret Thatcher in the United Kingdom. And you just were saying then, a minute ago, Philippe, that there's a resurgence of a kind of new left in France, whereas you've basically got the old right, as far as we're concerned, running the country. He's basically been rejected. I mean, the left never liked him, but I think, didn't he get Sarkozy get rejected by many elements on the conservative side because he was too pushy, too flashy, too, you know, he celebrated his victory hanging out with his rich friends on a yacht? My understanding is that his style even offended some conservatives in France.
Absolutely, you're absolutely correct about that. There's a personality issue when it comes to Sarkozy. In fact, I don't think the French ever warm up to the man. I think he, in the first place, won the 2007 election because his then opponent, Ségolène Royal, for the Socialist Party, wasn't seen as a credible president. So he beat her, and of course he wasn't the president yet, so no track record, if you like. But it is fair to say that from the start, there was a personality issue in a sense. You know, people didn't like so much his style, his mannerism. He can be a man sometimes a bit too casual, sometimes even rude in public. And the French, you know, surprisingly, this is another paradox of French political life. They abolished monarchy, they cut the king's throat, but in the end, they like this formality in politics, and their president is often seen as a kind of Republican monarch, you know, with a style, with a pomp. Think of De Gaulle, Mitterrand. They really embodied this sort of monarch in the French Republic. Sarkozy was different, and also the bling, you know, his bad manners, a number of things. He's a man who's seen, his nickname is the president of the rich people. So it is really something which went down very badly with the electorate at large. But I think that there's another, and I think a more profound problem with Sarkozy. It is his policies, notably in socioeconomic areas, which have been also very unpopular from the start. Number of reforms in pensions, in education, in public services, also in taxation. You know, one of the first measures he ever took when he was elected in 2007 was a reform of the tax system, which was extremely favoring the very rich, you know, the sort of 1% of the population very rich at the expense of the rest. So that was also seen as a kind of fiscal gift to the very rich. And from then on, it was very, very hard for him to be seen as a fair, impartial president above the melee. And he was seen, on the contrary, as a very partisan, very right-wing president. So what are we to make of all that? You said, yes, it's a kind of a belated version of Thatcherism or Reaganism in French politics, which is a bit funny because France never experienced a Reaganism or Thatcherism when it was in fashion in the US or in the UK. Yes, he tried that, some also nicknaming the French neocon. I don't know about that, but what is for sure is that the French have a tradition, you know, free markets to some extent, not too much of it. They're very attached to state intervention, notably strong, buoyant, well-funded public services. They're very proud of them in health, in education. And they're so progressively, which is in fact part of the French lifestyle, you know, which is sometimes talked about in the world, you know. How is it that the French have it so good? Well, probably because they, at some point, made the political decision to fund them. And it costs money, and to fund them by probably taking the money where it is from the rich, notably. That has changed progressively. I'm not saying it started with Sarkozy, but Sarkozy clearly has made it even worse. And I think the French have this sensation that, you know, they're losing their lifestyle. They're losing what makes France a little bit different from other European and world countries. And for all these reasons, he's seen as the man who is largely responsible for this loss of not only power of France in the world, but also the fact that France is no longer the France they knew before, which is a France where finally you could get jobs, but also you could get a good lifestyle. This is very important for the French. There's not only GDP at stake, there's also your lifestyle, how you live. Do you live well? And it's important for the French after a long, after working many years to be able to retire. And, you know, for them, work is important, but also when you come in old age, it's important to retire and not drop dead at work. You know, for all these reasons, all these reforms, for instance, in pensions, they were very unpopular. So I think he's paying the price for all these changes now.
So, Philippe Mallier, tell us a little about the likely next president, François Hollande. He apparently is, I suppose, a little bit like our Al Gore, who won the 2000 election, and the first thing he did was concede unnecessarily. And then later, of course, the Supreme Court, dominated by conservatives, gave George W. Bush the presidency, mm-hmm. In the sense that Al Gore was a stiff publicly, but in private, he was a very funny, witty, self-deprecating person. And I understand that François Hollande is a lot like that. He comes across rather stiff on the stump, but in private, he's quite charming and witty. And also, now, he was married to the woman that lost, right? Is that right?
Absolutely.
Tell us that. It sounds a little bit like a soap opera, but tell us about it.
Quite, yes. He was married to Ségolène Royal, in fact, the candidate for the Socialist Party 5 years ago, in 2007. At the time, Hollande was still the leader of the party. So imagine the leader of the party whose partner, because they were not married, although they have three children together, a partner running for the presidency while him being the leader of the main opposition party at the time. They split just after the campaign, just after the election. So Hollande, your depiction of Hollande, his character notably, is accurate. You know, he's a man who's seen as rather dull in public. He's led so far, I think, a very cautious campaign, not revealing too much about his intentions. I think he's proving quite astute, because although Sarkozy has had a very right-wing campaign and now very much prisoner, his fate is in the hands of the National Front voters, because his campaign has put him so much on the right of the political spectrum. Whereas Hollande has kept fairly centrist position, he's now going to get a large fraction of the left front vote, that is the New Left Party. He's going to get also the vote from the Greens, the Ecologist Party. So, without having to change his tactics or his orientation. So for him, it's things, you know, look pretty good for the second run. So yes, in private now, he's a pretty witty man, like Al Gore, funny. He's someone who's he's a bon vivant. He likes eating. One of the big changes is in his life, that is he lost 10 kilos before the campaign. That was one of the important things that he did before starting the campaign. He had to lose weight because he was overweight. But more seriously, when it comes to policy, he was always a centrist in the Socialist Party. He was always, if you like, a very moderate social democrat. He was he's no Mélenchon, the leader of the Left Front. He's a man who, on Europe, for instance, was always on the conservative side of the argument. He didn't vote against, for instance, the Constitutional Treaty in 2005 when the Socialist Party split on that issue. He's a man who will, I think, on a number of issues, have already hinted at austerity policy should he be elected. Of course, the difference with Sarkozy is that it's the pace and the depth and the scope of his austerity policies. He says that they can only be implemented if we renew with growth. Without growth, we can't have harsh austerity policy, because that will punish ordinary workers. So we'll not be doing that. However, he's talked about austerity policy. So on the whole, I think he wants to present himself as a kind of normal president. It's a bit the normalization of the function following the bling, the hyperactivism of Nicolas Sarkozy. which the French seems to be fed up with. So it's clearly going back to a kind of president which is not the sort of large character such as Mitterrand or de Gaulle or even Giscard d'Estaing in the 1970s, but a more modest type of presidency. It will be hard for him if he's elected because he's got very strong extreme right, and on the other hand, he's got also a strong resurgent left. So being a centrist but leading at the same time the left, it's a bit of a difficult equation for him.
Well, just in closing, Philippe Mahieu, already the European Commission, President of the European Commission, José Manuel Barroso, and the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, in reacting to that one in five French voters voted for the right-wing National Front, they've warned that right-wing populist politics are a threat to Europe. Give me your analysis of whether this is something to be concerned about.
Well, I think it's very ironic from the leaders of the European Union to come out and say, well, there's a threat of the far right. Of course there's a threat of the far right, and I would agree that it is something very worrying. However, that's what they say every time there is a surge of the far right, and not only in France, you know, when it happens in other European countries. Because the far right is, of course, is not only, unfortunately, only a French phenomenon. It has become a European phenomenon across Europe. So they will come out and say that, you know, be careful. I think there's a lot of analysis and available studies in the academic world to show that, in fact, there's a correlation between the rise of the extreme right and the deepening of economic recession and the fact that now more and more Europeans live in poverty, have to face very harsh conditions in terms of wages, in terms of unemployment, in terms of and they also worry about the future of their children, education, and so on and so forth. So there is a correlation, and when you really carry out qualitative studies amongst the population which voted for Le Pen yesterday, you realize that these are people really worried about their future. They're not, as you were saying earlier, you know, committed fascists in the sense they believe in fascist ideology. Not at all. It's people really saying we are against this elite in France, in Europe, this establishment, which has been, you know, implementing all these policies, making us pay for the crisis that we're not responsible for. And why? You know, we need to change the system. So it's really a protest vote in the sense that they want really a new set of policies to really change the situation. But of course, that's not what European leaders or French leaders or Nicolas Sarkozy, that is, are doing. So of course, this crisis and the vitality, the strength of the extreme right is, I'm afraid, there to stay.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Philippe
Mahieu. You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Philippe Mahieu, who's a professor of French and European politics at University College London. In 2007, he was awarded the Marcel Liebman Chair in Political Science by the Université Libre de Bruxelles. His main publications are about the French Socialist Party, French politics, and European social democracy. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back getting an economic analysis of where the Eurozone stands and how much this election may affect it. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Dimitri Papadimitriou, who is the president of the Levy Economics Institute and the Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He's testified on a number of occasions before committees of the United States Congress, was vice chairman of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress, and was a member of the Competitive Policy Council's Sub-Council on Capital Allocation. He was also a distinguished scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dimitri Papadimitriou.
Thank you very much for having me.
And of course, today on Wall Street, the stocks tumbled sharply. European stocks really took a dip. Then the Dow was down 103 on the news of the Dutch government collapsing and on French President Nicolas Sarkozy losing the first round and likely to be replaced by the socialist candidate. But nevertheless, we've spoken a few times about the kind of malaise in terms of Europe's ability to deal with its ongoing problems in the Eurozone. Clearly, today's events are not a good indicator. But where would you rate the situation today, given our earlier conversations where we always said, you know, when are the Europeans going to get their hands around this problem?
I am not surprised with the events of today. As I had indicated previously, the general population in Europe, except Germany, perhaps, is the anti-austerity trend. So we will see the sentiment coming in from conservatives, coming in for socialists, coming in for from members of parties that are ultra-nationalists, as we have seen the important showing of Marine Le Pen in France, as we see, for instance, some changing of tune from the conservatives in Greece, even though they did agree to the second memorandum and the austerity conditionalities that they have placed on Greece. But nevertheless, in order to go in concert with the general sentiment, they have to actually present themselves that they either have to renegotiate the terms, or they basically have to do something to deal with the events of high poverty, very high unemployment, especially among young people, and the dark future that it appears to be all over Europe, with the exclusion of Germany. As you correctly pointed out, we see problems also with the government in the Netherlands, as well as we see that there is some capital flight out of the Netherlands, out of Belgium, and out of places where they appear to be secure, such as France and towards Germany. But Germany cannot accommodate that capital in flight. And therefore, there is a sense that the Eurozone isn't looking quite good for in the very near future. I hate to be the Cassandra, but on the other hand, there are no omens there that will let me see anything positive.
Well, on Saturday, Christine Lagarde, the president of the International Monetary Fund, said a global undifferentiated rush to austerity will ultimately prove self-defeating. But she also acknowledged the quandary facing European leaders, and that is that they simply don't have the resources to pay for stimulus programs like public works projects that would ease the pain of the unemployment that you mentioned, in about 30% amongst the young in France and over 50% amongst the young in Spain, and of course, the across-the-board declining wages. So how do you deal with this? You have Spain having trouble financing its existing debt, let alone coming up with any more stimulus spending to get out of the hole.
Well, you see, the difficulty is that if the decisions are being made in Berlin, and Berlin doesn't have to worry about growth, doesn't have to worry about unemployment, since it is enjoying really a good economic data, such as growth and employment and so on. It's very difficult for them to accept that there is a stimulus effect that will bring actually the rest of the member states of the Eurozone in a growth path. And therefore, unless there's some leadership that comes from the quarters of the newly elected, whether it would be in France, whether it would be in Greece or Spain and Italy, finally decide that the path that they have embarked following austerity isn't going to deliver the goods and the targets are going to be missed, then I suspect that we will wait a few months more, perhaps a year, until things come to a complete stop. As you know, the IMF has been coming with projections about growth in Spain, which are abysmal. They are coming with projections in Greece, which are abysmal. They are coming with projections that they're not good for Italy. They're asking for postponement. Governments across Europe are asking for postponement of meeting these deficit targets. And you can do this without any growth. The targets are not going to be met, not in 2 years, but not in 3 years. So unless there is a what I would call a European Marshall Plan, we're looking for some for a tunnel that basically does not have light at its end. Now, one could question, how could we do it? Well, you know, there is an incomplete project in the Eurozone. You have a monetary union, but you have no fiscal union. And therefore, it's a different situation to have a monetary union, which is the same as being in a gold standard and not being able to have any room to maneuver. That's not what it was intended to have in a Eurozone or even the larger situation as the European Union. So I have to say that even in the monetary union, we find ourselves that a central bank, whose function should include being a lender of last resort, is absent. And the expectation is that somehow or other, the lender of last resort doesn't need to be present, and that countries through austerity should be able to maintain the monetary union and to maintain the use of a currency which is not their own. Clearly, we see the results of it. And my suspicion is that at the end of the day, if Germany is the only country standing, it might actually decide that it's time for Germany to leave, to exit the euro. Instead of having a talk about Greece exiting Europe or perhaps Spain or Italy or Portugal, I think the most likely is that the German people might actually decide at the end that they cannot afford to be in the euro.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Dimitri Papadimitriou, who's president of the Levy Economics Institute and Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. You mentioned the dismal growth rate in Spain, Dimitri. In fact, they're in a recession. Their output fell 0.4%. And then already in recession are Italy, Belgium, and the Netherlands, and then, you know, nearby outside of the Eurozone, the Czech Republic. So there is, I mean, the point that you just made is actually quite extraordinary that we've heard so much talk about Greece leaving the Eurozone and the idea that maybe at the end of the day, Germany may just walk away. They've been the beneficiaries of it largely, having created vast export markets, and they did do all the profligate lending. That wouldn't mean that they're going to walk away from those debts, is it? I mean, I don't think they're being very honest about their debts, are they, the Germans?
Well, they're not, because, you know, their debt is, as it stands now, higher than that of Spain. So the issue here is, can they afford to stay in the Eurozone? Because after all the rescue packages that are being offered, the two of them in Greece, the one in Portugal, the one in Ireland, and perhaps the forthcoming one in Spain, ultimately the major responsibility is really Germany's, because that's really how they have boxed themselves in, to be the only growing economy at the expense of the other member states of the Eurozone. It seems, therefore, that at the end, and they may not happen while Angela Merkel is the chancellor, but let's not forget that she's coming up for re-election next year, and things don't look that good for her either. Not that the SPD is going to do anything different, but perhaps might come to a realization that the way the game is being played, there is not going to be any winners. My suspicion, therefore, is that after the elections of France, things might change dramatically, because even if Mrs. Sarkozy were to win by securing the votes of Marie Le Pen, I don't think he can continue on the same path as he has started. He also has made some moves, perhaps their election pronouncement, pre-election pronouncements, that the ECB has to also consider as part of its job the growth and not only price stability. That, of course, comes totally against what Germany believes, because the ECB is actually a blueprint of the Bundestag. And the Bundesbank basically has only one goal in mind, and that is price stability.
So I think most analysts there, Dimitri Papadimitriou, don't think that Sarkozy has much of a chance. And what would happen then with this François Hollande's administration, huge critic, of course, of austerity? Again, the questions arise, where does the stimulus come from?
He has suggested, if in fact he's the winner, that he was not going to go along with the social compact. And the social compact, if you recall, called for every member state to adopt a budget rule, a balanced budget rule constitutionally. So if that's not going to happen, then of course we'll be looking for a fiscal union. And a fiscal union might be the answer if the Eurozone is to actually survive, because then you will have a project that perhaps goes to its completion. To have a United States of Europe to be in some ways similar to the United States of America, where when New York sends more money in terms of tax receipts to Washington, it receives much less than the opposite situation might be in Delaware, where it receives a lot more than what it sends to the federal government, with a U.S. Treasury that does the job of monitoring the fiscal revenue sharing, if you like, because that's really what a union is supposed to do.
So in closing then, Dimitri Papadimitriou, let's look at the politics a little bit in terms of, for a long time, for example, George Soros, himself a Holocaust survivor, has been concerned about the European malaise and has warned that if Europe doesn't get its hands around this crisis and create the kind of firewalls and the Federal Reserve mechanism necessary, there's going to be a return to right-wing politics that, of course, the tragic 30s and 40s were rife with. And to some extent, some of his dire predictions seem to be taking place. If we're to look at the election results in France, where you have 30% unemployment and the youth and 50% in Spain. Spain's not heading in a fascist direction, but the young French workers, they tend to be the working class kids, did vote for the right-wing ticket. Is that some kind of harbinger, do you think?
Yes, I think so. I think the ideological shifts are going to take place, and this is actually quite frightening. When you talk about being reminiscent of the Great Depression, well, these were the numbers that we were confronted with during the Great Depression. One was talking about 25% unemployment. Well, in France, we don't have 23%, 24%, but we do have it in Spain, and Spain is a large economy. So you can't really expect, unless there is a New Deal type of a thing that Roosevelt have implemented, there's no way that you can expect that the market somehow or other will find a solution, that Angela Merkel seems to think that somehow or other, if we put our house in order in terms of fiscal responsibility, things will work out miraculously. So I think that when George Soros is talking about it, I think he's actually quite right. You know, those kinds of things can be solved and if there is spectacular understanding, not mediocre understanding of what really is at stake. You know, the ECB, if it were to be the lender of last resort, we would stabilize the financial markets immediately. If there's always a buyer of last resort, the markets wouldn't have to worry about having to price Italian bonds or Spanish bonds on the expectation that there might be default. And the same thing if there was a fiscal union. That in fact, a stimulus packages using the currency of the union would have been not be the same problem as we have now, where every member state is fending for itself.
Well, but it's just, it leads you to absolutely scratch your head about the ECB, and you refer to it more as the Bundesbank, the German bank. With all of these problems we've discussed here, Dmitry Papadimitriou, inflation is the last one that they should be worried about.
Right. But that's what they're worried. Even if it's non-existent, we have the president of the Bundesbank worried about the long-term refinancing operations, the LTRO, that President Draghi actually implemented to support Italian and Spanish bonds. And they're worried about it, and they're talking about exiting, without realizing that if indeed the ECB were to announce this, the interest rates will go through the roof.
Well, we can only scratch our heads, and I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dmitry Papadimitriou.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dmitry Papadimitriou, who's president of the Levy's Economics Institute and the Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He's testified on a number of occasions before committees of the House of Representatives and the United States Senate, was vice chairman of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress, and was a member of the Competitive Policy Council Subcommittee on Capital Allocation. And he's also a distinguished scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.